Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, joined here by Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. And Matt, pretty interesting show, I think, this week. We need to look back on a few of the awards that actually just came out over the last couple of days. It's a fun week for baseball, finding out who wins MVP, Cy Young, etc. We're going to get to our all StatCast team, which I think will be pretty interesting. I have a couple of pitchers I want to talk about who maybe deserved better than they got. And of course, Jerry DePoto made a trade. So we have to talk about Jerry DePoto.
Two trades, actually. But
well, we're not going to get into both the trades. So we're going to get into a lot of this. But first, I think a lot of the awards we saw this last week were as expected, right? Aaron Judge, unanimous Rookie of the Year. Cody Bellinger, unanimous Rookie of the Year. Not a whole lot of surprise there, right?
Nope.
I mean, I have my opinions about the down ballot votes in the Rookie of the Year, but not so much that it's really that big of a deal.
Yeah, there are too many issues in the world to get concerned about down ballot awards votes.
Exactly right. Corey Kluber wins the American League Cy Young. Totally unsurprising, by 28 first place votes to 2. It was maybe a little more than I thought it would be, but obviously he was going to win. Max Scherzer crushes the NL Cy Young, 27 first place votes to 3. Maybe I thought that would be a little bit closer, but it wasn't.
And he broke the Tom Tango Cy Young predictor.
He did. The Tom Tango Cy Young predictor usually predicts that a pitcher who has more wins and a lower ERA will bubble up above the pitcher on top of him, and that's what Kershaw should have done, but he didn't. So I don't think that means the predictor was wrong so much as voters are getting smarter. This is great. They don't care about wins anymore.
Great trivia question for you. You know the last time someone led the league in wins and ERA and did not win the Cy Young?
I think I saw this on Twitter, and I want to say it was like Mike Boddicker.
That is correct. Mike Boddicker for the 1984 Orioles.
Okay, that is certainly a trivia question. Jose Altuve wins the American League MVP, again, by a little bit more than I would have thought. 27 first place votes to 2 for Aaron Judge. Somehow Jose Ramirez got a first place vote. I don't even know who did that, but I mean, I like Jose Ramirez. First place?
There was a 3-day period in the midst of the Indians' win streak when it looked like narrative might carry. When they had 22 games?
I can't even remember at this point.
When they had that long win streak and Ramirez was playing great and there was just like Indians fever and there was like the brief moment where it looked like, the narrative of that streak and Ramirez's like great season might carry him to the award. But then, the Indians fell off a little bit. The streak ended. People were like, oh yeah, Altuve's amazing. Judge also finished really strong. So, Altuve winning, it's pretty cool.
I would have voted for Aaron Judge. And just one more note on the AL MVP. Byron Buxton got some down ballot support, which is, if you think about how his season started off, the fact that that's possible, I think is really cool. It says a lot about how voters are starting to like value speed and defense. It's not just about batting average anymore and home runs. And he's maybe going to be my MVP choice next season.
Yeah, and I'm not a voter, and Mike is a BBWA member, but he did not vote on this. So this wasn't us voting for Buxton.
It was not us. And then the NL MVP, this is the most interesting one, I think. Giancarlo Stanton won by 2 points, 302 points to 300 points. Joey Votto, they each got 10 first-place votes. Giancarlo Stanton got 10 second-place votes. Joey Votto got 9 second-place votes. This one, it's essentially a tie. For all intents and purposes, it's a tie. Stanton comes away with the award. He is a perfectly deserving candidate. I don't really think you can look at this and say, oh, he did not earn it. Obviously, he did. I thought Joey Votto should have won for like 9 different reasons. I'm actually a little disappointed that he didn't. If I had been a voter, I might have been the swing vote that turned this to Joey Votto.
So I guess I'm curious, why do you think in your mind clearly Votto was the choice? Because to me, they're basically even and I could go either way. I don't have a strong feeling on it. But I'm curious to hear why you think Votto was the quote unquote obvious choice.
Stanton was a good choice. And I think Votto would have been a great choice because he leads in pretty much every category I care about. If you just want to look at our favorite stat, expected weighted on base, well, that's Joey Votto. If you care about traditional stats, well, he hit, 320 with 36 home runs? That's Joey Votto. If you care about defensive metrics, he had, I believe, plus 11 defensive runs saved, tied for first among first basemen. He really had it all, and he has mastered, I think he's on a Hall of Fame track, right? I don't think that's super controversial anymore.
It should not be.
And this might have been his best season. Right, he masters the strike zone. We're going to get to him in a second because he's on our all StatCast team. But he masters the strike zone like nobody we've ever seen. He hits for power. He gets on base. I think he had more than a 2-to-1 walk to strikeout ratio, which is insane right now. And I don't care that his team was bad. I really, truly do not care about that. I know a lot of people do. For me, it was Joey Votto, and it wasn't close.
The most amazing Joey Votto awards fact, I think, is that he has won an MVP. In fact, I think it was actually was it 2010? It was 7 years ago.
It was.
He's like been a great player for a long time. But somehow he's never won a Silver Slugger Award.
I have a lot of thoughts about the Silver Slugger Award.
But I mean, that's almost, it's just sort of, like, that almost feels like, people have been going out of their way not to give it to him. The fact that he has not in his career won that award as the best hitting first baseman in the National League is kind of hard to believe.
I do want to focus on something I found really weird and unexpected about Giancarlo Stanton this year. When StatCast came online in 2015, you'd probably agree that he was sort of the first face of StatCast, right? That first season, the first year we can measure exit velocity, you know, everybody in the world knew he hit the ball hard. But we saw him hitting the ball harder than everybody, and we were actually able to put numbers in context to this. And we're like, wow. And then I guess 2016, I don't know, Seth Lugo is maybe the face of StatCast. And then this year, it's been more of a Judge Buxton sort of thing. But when
Perdomo.
I look, we'll get, listen, we will have our weekly Luis Perdomo fun fact later on in the show. But when I look at Stanton, over the 3 years of StatCast, I found his trends fascinating. The first year, his average exit velocity, 95.9 miles an hour. It was the best in baseball. 387 guys had 100 balls in play. His 95.9 was the best. Last year, 2016, 93.9, so that's down 2 miles an hour. Still second, still great.
It also feels like within, you know, we don't have a huge sample size to work with, but that feels like within a standard deviation. It doesn't feel crazy. Like I agree. You might shuffle a mile per hour or two every year.
I agree. But so that was just the second year. And then in 2017, down to 91.9, another 2 miles an hour. Now, as you say, I hesitate to use the word trend, I guess. We're only looking at 3 years of data. There's not a lot here. But for a guy who was really introduced as this is the guy who will hit the ball harder than anybody to drop 2 miles an hour each year, I found that really interesting. Now, you're surely thinking to yourself, well, hang on a minute. He hit 59 home runs this year. Certainly he's doing something right. I think a big part of that was obviously he stayed healthy. Big part of that is everybody in baseball hit more home runs this year. He also made more contact. His strikeout rate in 2015, 29.9%, then 29.8%. This year down to 23.6%. So simply putting the bat on the ball more often. And this was what I found the most interesting because everybody in baseball is trying to elevate, but not Giancarlo Stanton. His launch angle has dropped each of the 3 years. 15.5 degrees the first year, 14 degrees the next year, and only 11.1 degrees this year. So he's hitting the ball more often, which is great. He's hitting it more softly, which is kind of weird. And he's hitting it at a lower launch angle, which is, it's not exactly the recipe you expect from baseball players these days. Like, everything about that is backwards. Everybody's hitting it higher, harder, and with less contact. And here's Stanton doing literally the opposite of all three of those things.
That is a fantastic transition to another player related to the NL MVP discussion who generated a fair amount of discussion last night, and that's Chris Bryant. Chris Bryant, I guess to the surprise of many, received one first-place MVP vote from our colleague Mark Bowman, our Atlanta Braves beat reporter. And, you know, Mark took some grief about it on social media, as is happens these days. And he wrote an explainer piece sort of explaining his logic behind voting for Bryant, giving him credit for his consistency and the fact that, you know, he sort of his ascent, his best baseball, like, coincided with the Cubs' ascent in the second half of the season. But in regards to Bryant, you know, I actually don't think the MVP vote was as crazy as many people think it was, for reasons I'll get to in a second. But similar to Stanton, he's one of the only guys, or similar to Stanton and similar to and going against the trend in baseball this year, his launch angle dropped significantly this year, going way down from his 2016 MVP year. In 2016, he won MVP. His average launch angle was 20.9 degrees. This year, 2017, 17 degrees. It's notable because Bryant's season, the arc of how he got to his production was very different, but his overall offensive numbers were basically identical. In 2016, weighted runs created plus was 148. 2017, 146. 2016, his weighted on base, 396. 2017, actually a little higher, 399.
And I remember pointing this out on Twitter at various points during the season, like saying, hey, this guy, I know the Cubs aren't doing what you expected them to. This guy's having another pretty great season. And, man, people hated that. They freaked out about it. They're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, listen, I wouldn't have put him number one. I think the reasons behind it were totally understandable. Mark did a good job of explaining himself. But yeah, you're right. His seasons overall were very, very, very similar. And I think there's two reasons why he didn't look quite as shiny this year. I think part of it is just there's a lot more competition this year. Like, this is the deepest MVP race I think I can remember. But then also, as I think you're going to get to, some of the top line numbers were simply different. There were fewer home runs. Who does that these days?
Yeah, 2016, 39 homers. 2017, 29 homers, a drop of 10 home runs. But the big difference, he walked a lot more. His on-base percentage went from 385 to 409. So, you know, he's giving up some power, and it also showed up in His exit velocity, his average exit velocity was down 2 miles an hour from 89.3 to 87. His hard hit rate was down from 39 point, then hard hit rate being defined as 95 miles per hour, bat a ball with 95 miles per hour or above exit velocity. 39.2 in 2016, 37% in 2017. His barrels are a hard hit metric for, you know, sort of an ideal, perfectly struck batted ball with a high probability of an extra base hit. He had 54 of those in 2016, 41 in 2017. So he definitely, it seems like a little bit similar standing that he's maybe sacrificing a little bit in terms of, like, you know, go for broke swings. But in exchange, he's getting on base a lot more. And as, you know, early sabermetric adopters can tell you, the most important thing a batter can do is not make an out. And Bryant did that a lot better this year than he did last year in his MVP season. He got 29 of 30 MVP votes last year.
Yeah, I would say the idea that Bryant had somehow a disappointing season is total garbage. He had another very, very strong season. I think just not as strong as some of the competition. That's the way I would put it.
Yeah, the two other thoughts I'll have on Bryant are this, is that, you know, the first place MVP vote stands out. But to me, it's no more out of place than two first place votes for Nolan Arenado, who had like a 128 weighted runs created plus, 28 percentage points above league average. You know, Bryant's at 146. Blackman is at 141.
And those are park adjusted.
Those are park adjusted numbers. And, you know, Arenado, a fantastic defender, although his and I don't put a lot of weight in single season defensive metrics, but his defensive numbers this year were not out of this world. And, you know, Arenado's a fine player. I think he's a great player, but I think that there's a perception. This is one player I go against the grain. I think there's a perception amongst a lot of analysts and a lot of fans that he is amongst the inner circle best players in baseball year in and year out. And in my estimation, he's maybe the third, maybe fourth best third baseman in baseball, and probably more in the second tier outside of the Trout, Altuve, Bryant, you know, to me, Bryce Harper, Clayton Kershaw group.
Which is not an insult, by
no,
the
it's
way.
Not.
I mean, that
it's
makes
not.
Him one of the best players in baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you totally on that. As I've always said, I wouldn't have voted him for NL MVP because I don't think he's the team MVP. I thought Charlie Blackman is more valuable this year. But it's immaterial. They finished fourth and fifth. They're both great players. And I think of all the votes, this one was by far the most interesting, both at the top and what happened afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. It was one of the closest votes ever. And, you know, we had, I guess, six players with our first place votes. Six, because Rendon did not get any first place votes, which surprised me.
Maybe the most underrated player
exactly.
in baseball now.
He's also in the discussion of best third baseman in the game. One other Bryant point is that, you know, when I first thought about it, I was like, well, maybe people dinged him because, you know, he hit fewer home runs. And, you know, who in baseball is hitting fewer home runs this year? Well, I went back and looked at the home run leaders from 2016.
This list is amazing. I'm looking at this now for the first time.
2016 home run leaders, I looked at the 17 players who hit more than 35 homers. And I guess, you know, this is regression to the mean at its finest. Basically, all of them hit significantly fewer home runs this year than they did last year.
I think I see one guy who hit more home runs, and that's Chris with a K Davis, who just went up from 42 to 43.
Yeah, but everyone else dropped. Trumbo, 47 to 23. Nelson Cruz, 43 to 39. Encarnacion, 42 to 38. Dozier, 42 to 34. Arenado, 41 to 37.
Right.
Chris Carter, 41 to 8.
I mean, you know, big Poppy were retired, obviously. Like,
yeah.
Chris with the C Davis didn't have a great year. Miggy got hurt. Machado got off the slow start. Donaldson got hurt. Matt Kemp got hurt. You're right. I mean, a lot of this is regression.
We had players on the other side, you know, who jumped up in a big way with home run numbers. Obviously, Aaron Judge bursting on the scene and hitting,
sure.
you know, 52.
Here's
and
Chris Taylor up. With 25
yeah, exactly.
or whatever. And
but,
like,
Yes, Bryant dropped 10 homers, but that was not out of line at all with the other home run leaders from 2016. And sort of a good reminder next year that, you know, Aaron Judge may only hit 45 home runs, but that's probably kind of to be expected because it's hard to hit 50-plus home runs every year.
I'm torn between, yes, you're 100% right, and also he hit that many home runs while basically not making contact for six straight weeks. So as far as how I'm going to value him heading into next year, I have literally no idea. Let's talk about a trade that happened, but first, let's take a moment to tell you about our friends over at the Cut Forecast. It's the podcast from the staff of MLB.com's Cut Four section. They focus on the lighter side of baseball. If you've made it this far into our podcast, you'll really enjoy theirs. It'll make you laugh, and you might even learn something about baseball dogs or ballpark food. Last week's episode featured the presentation of the Cy Dunn Award for Best Position Player Pitching, the Julio Franco Award for the Best Old Man Baseball Player, and other prestigious hardware. That sounds like something you're into. Search the Cut Forecast, C-U-T, number 4, C-A-S-T, in Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you consume your podcasts, and click subscribe. Can we talk about a trade?
Yes.
At this point in the season, anytime a trade happens, it's immediately interesting. I think this was the first trade of the offseason. And this is probably not going to be a trade full of names that everybody knows. The trade was Seattle and Oakland. So Seattle acquires infielder Ryan with an O, Healy, for reliever Emilio Pagan and a minor league shortstop, Alex Campos. There's probably a significant portion of our listener base who has never heard of any of those three names. Hi, Dad. And I think it's interesting. What I thought of when I saw this trade, it was being pitched as the Ryan Healy trade, right? Ryan Healy at 25 home runs last year, and you know the A's traded him to Seattle, and he's going to be their first baseman. And my immediate thought was the Todd Frazier trade, because when that trade happened, everybody thought of it as the Todd Frazier trade. But I remember we were talking about it. We're like, hold on a minute. This is the David Robertson, Tommy Canley trade, and also Todd Frazier happened to be part of it. And that's kind of how I feel about this. Yes, Ryan Healy hit 25 home runs last year. He also had a 302 on-base percentage and a 3% walk rate. That comes out in the wash to a league average player. His 313 expected weighted on-base was tied for 209th out of 428 hitters. It's basically middle of the pack, similar to Jason Hayward, Joe Panik, Jacoby Ellsbury. He's got some pop, got some flaws in his game. The point here is not about Ryan Healy. The guy I'm interested in is the reliever that the A's got, Emilio Pagan. He was a rookie last year, threw 50 and a third innings, 56 strikeouts and 8 walks. That's fantastic. 3.22 ERA, which is fine. Of the 254 relievers who faced 100 batters, his 2.41 expected weighted on base, which remember counts for strikeouts and walks and quality of contact, exit velocity, launch angle, of 254, he was tied for 11th best. Like, similar to Tommy Canley and David Robertson and Brandon Morrow and Chad Green. I'm not saying that he's going to maintain this forever, but this is a guy I'd barely ever heard of, and then I saw where he ranked on our leaderboard, and I was like, this is really interesting. I actually kind of like this for the A's, even though they gave up the power hitter.
Well, I love this for the A's because they actually, I mean, Ryan Healy, if there's one thing the A's have, it's players like Ryan
Yes.
Healy. They've got Chris of the K. Davis. They've got Matt Olson. They've got even Chad Pinder, who can hit dingers. There's people I'm forgetting this class of player they have. This is like the A's have sort of, in some ways, their lineup is reminiscent of like the John Jaha, Jason Giambi, like true Moneyball A's days.
I think I've said this before. I'm kind of in on the A's for next year, right? Like, I really like this trade. I think they've got a lot of really interesting young pitchers. The guys at the infield corners, I know nobody paid attention to the A's in the second half of the season, but Matt Olson and Matt Chapman, for different reasons, were fantastic. I think there's a lot of reason to like the A's. I'm not saying they're going to be better than the Astros because they're not, but they could be interesting. And what I also liked about this trade, and this was brought up by our friend Dave Cameron at Fangraphs, could you have imagined just like 3 years ago, after the 2014 season, when power was down, home runs were down, somebody trading a young first baseman who could hit for power for a rookie reliever, and us thinking that the team that got the reliever made the great deal. It's amazing how quickly things have changed.
And I'm a little surprised by it, just because, you know, the Mariners have had bullpen issues of their own, and there is, like, you know, I know Healy's under team control for a few years. He can play a couple positions, so, like, I understand why, like, a team might value him, but obviously he doesn't walk, like, at all. And there are, you know, first base DH types readily available on the market this offseason that could, you know, you wouldn't have to give up talent to go get. I guess that's sort of, you know, your Logan Morrison. I guess they've already had the Logan Morrison experience, but your Lucas Dudas.
Sure.
There's others that I'm probably forgetting. So just for me, it seems like an odd trade for the Mariners.
Well, after Danny Valencia and after Yonder Alonso and now Ryan Healy, I'm looking forward to, I guess, the 2020 season when Matt Olson will be playing first base in Seattle, because that seems to be the pipeline. Before we get to the All-Statcast team, let's talk a little bit about some pitchers who deserved better. And I think with any kind of stat, it's always really fun to try to predict who you think might be more valuable next year. It does not take any sort of effort to say, hey, I think Max Scherzer is going to be good next year. Yes, he will. But if you look a little bit deeper into the skills, you might be able to find something that isn't readily available just by the top-level stats. So what I did here is I compared ERA to expected weighted on base. And that's interesting, I think, because you can have a really great quality of contact and still not really perform well. You can have a bullpen that lets in all your inherited runners. You can have terrible batted ball luck. You can have a defense who just does not help you at all. You can play in a terrible ballpark. There's a lot of reasons you could be a good pitcher and have poor results, right? Like, every 5.5 ERA does not come equally. Sometimes you're bad, and that's why, and sometimes other things happen. So if I had done this last year, I probably would have called out Anthony Swarzak and his 5.52 ERA last year. Kirby Yates had a 5.32 ERA last year. Shane Green, Aaron Nola, both around 5. Last year, they had a very good expected weighted on base and very poor ERA. And all those guys had really good years this year. I'm obviously cherry picking. There are guys I would have called out who didn't have good years this year. Nothing's 100%. But I think this is a really interesting way to just get past results and into skills and into process. So let's talk about a couple of the guys I pulled out. I think Jeff Samardzija, right, is probably the most obvious one. A 4.42 ERA, which is not great. For expected weighted on base league average is 3.14. So he had a 2.94. Very similar to Robbie Ray, who had a 2.89 ERA, and John Gray, 3.67 ERA. Samardzija increased his strikeouts from 20% to 24, lowered his walks, had 205 strikeouts and 32 walks. That is the second best strikeout to walk rate in the National League. Now, like everybody else on this list, he gave up more home runs because that's just a thing that happened in baseball this year. But when I look at Samardzija, I see a guy who had poor outfield defense behind him, an ineffective bullpen, and I think this is a guy who probably deserved better than a 4.42 ERA.
Yeah, I can't help but think that the performance of Denard Span, who I think was last in our outs above average.
Second last to Kemp, I think.
Okay, so last, yeah. We're center fielder in terms of outs above average. Had something to do with this number, because, you know, Samardzija is a guy who gives up a fair amount of fly balls, a spacious outfield. So, you know, without having gone and, you know, looked at the film or looked more closely at the batted ball profile, it's a hunch that that Span had a role there.
I agree with you, and I want to repeat that exact same argument for Marco Estrada. Marco Estrada had a 4.98 ERA. A year ago, he made the All-Star team. His ERA was like 3.50 or something. But his expected weighted on base of 2.99, almost identical to the previous year. His strikeouts and walks were the same. If you look at somebody who had a similar expected weighted on base this year, Kyle Hendricks, 3.03 ERA. Madison Bumgarner, 3.32 ERA. So how did Marco Estrada get an ERA of nearly 5? Well, the Blue Jays' outfield was, to put it kindly, terrible. Kevin Pillar took a step back. Jose Bautista, obviously, is not really going to be an everyday outfielder anymore. They didn't really have a left fielder. If you look at his batting average on balls in play, 2015 it was 2.02. 2016 it was 2.02. And last year it was 2.54. So I do think, you know, a noted fly ball pitcher saw fewer balls landing in gloves, and that, you know, increased the ERA. So I'm not going to go through everybody on this list here. I have an article coming out about it. But one other guy I do want to touch on, just because I love finding a guy that no one's ever heard of, Kevin Shackelford. Have you ever heard of Kevin Shackelford?
I've heard the name, but I can't tell you anything about
him. Kevin Shackelford was a rookie reliever for the Cincinnati Reds. And when you see a 28-year-old rookie reliever with a 4.70 ERA, you probably wouldn't even spend 5 more seconds investigating it. You think there's nothing here. However, 2.59 expected weighted on base is very similar to Chris Devensky and Cody Allen, who both had ERAs under 3. He struck out 38 guys in his first 30 and two-thirds innings. After giving up 9 runs in his first 7 games, then only 7 runs in his final 19 games, they actually acquired him for Jonathan Broxton once upon a time. And, you know, I'm hopeful that some of these guys on this list, I've also included Kenta Maeda, Jarrell Cotton, Mark Melancon, Cam Bedrosian, will have bounce back seasons next year, and then I can point back to them and then ignore these guys on the list who don't have good seasons next year. That's kind of the way these things work.
Let's get to the All-Statcast team.
Okay, let's define the All-Statcast team. This is not what people think it is. It's not a list. It's not the best players in baseball. Now, some of these guys are, but there's no Clayton Kershaw on this team. There's no Mike Trout on this team. This is one player at every position who has done something extremely interesting from a Statcast point of view. Maybe he's the fastest guy at the position, you know, that best throwing arm, whatever. All the skills we can measure, that's the guys we've named to this team here.
And those of you listening might get a sneak preview. Mike is writing this up for the site. We'll roll out over this weekend, and this is the third annual All-Statcast team.
It is. And when I wrote this up, I think I actually mentioned this in the intro, is like the tools we have now as compared to the tools I had when we did this in 2015, I think the first year it was like entirely exit velocity and spin rate. And now it's like, well, we have catch probability, we have sprint speed, we have all expected weighted on base, we have all sorts of fun stuff. So I think some of these won't surprise you terribly.
Yeah, long-time listeners will have heard some of these names before. But
some are obvious, right? For example, at catcher, I thought about Gary Sanchez and his cannon arm, but I went with JT Realmuto of the Miami Marlins, who I believe is Major League Baseball's most athletic catcher. And that makes sense. They signed him as an infielder. He was a quarterback in high school, a wrestler, and all this. Had a pretty good season with the bat, 3.32 on base, 4.51 slugging. He is the fastest catcher in baseball by kind of a lot. His sprint speed is 28.6 feet per second. The major league average is 27. 28.6 with the next fastest catcher, Wilson Contreras, being 27.4. There were only 3 catchers, Austin Barnes being the other, who topped 27 feet per second. So he's not just the fastest catcher by a little bit. He's the fastest catcher by a lot. And I think that's interesting. We've never really been able to measure that before this year. He also has elite pop time. He had a pop time average of 1.89 seconds to second base, tied with Austin Hedges for baseball's best among 58 catchers with 10 stolen bases. You combine those two things, and I see baseball's most athletic catcher.
Obvious choice.
Obvious choice. Now, first base is a little tougher. I went with Joey Votto, and there's a lot of different ways you could have gone in this direction, right? But I went with Joey Votto for plate discipline. And I know that doesn't necessarily sound like a Statcast thing, but it is, because if you look at baseballsavant.com, we introduced what we call the detailed strike zone. It's not just in the zone or outside the zone. You can also select the edges of the zone, which is really important. And what I found this number, and I thought this was fascinating. There were 323 batters who saw at least 300 pitches outside that zone. So really, the terrible pitches. Not a single one of those hitters took a swing at fewer of those pitchers than Joey Votto. Out of those terrible pitches outside the zone, he went after just 5%. At the other end, Sal Perez went after nearly 40%. This is a big deal. I mean, and you can see it in the outcomes, right? When Joey Votto made contact inside the zone around the edges, he hit 347, 88 miles an hour exit velocity. When he actually made contact with those terrible pitches outside, 0.063 batting average, a 68 mile an hour exit velocity. Controlling the strike zone is maybe the single most important thing you can do. Also, no hitter in baseball had fewer of his pitches coming from behind in the count. This is the Joey Votto story in a nutshell.
Yep. It's second base.
Second base. Okay. Jose Altuve. And I found him interesting because we talked a lot about Altuve versus Judge in the MVP conversation. Altuve, for all of the great things he does, is not a terribly interesting Statcast player, right? He doesn't really stand out in anything. But obviously, he's great at a lot of things. What I thought was interesting about him here is that he's really shown this ability to turn speed on when he needs it. So his sprint speed of 28 feet per second, it's above average for sure.
But
it's
average is 27 feet per second.
Right. It's not elite.
27 feet per second.
The elite guys are up about 30 feet per second. Even just looking at second baseman, he is tied for eighth. He's similar to like Ricky Odor, Brian Dozier. Fast, but not crazy fast. But we also saw that when he scored that winning run in ALCS Game 2, came all the way around from first, he got up to 29.5 feet per second. He turned it on when he needed it. There was also a game in September, and I think we talked about it here at the time. He set a record for the fastest home to first we've ever tracked, 3.33 seconds. He's a righty, and he wasn't bunting, which is impressive. Yeah. So he's got the ability to tap into that speed when he needs it. And he actually gave me an idea that I need to look into when I was writing this. I want to find out what guys have the largest difference between their average sprint speed and their maximum sprint speed. You know, who's operating at full capacity and who actually has the ability to add someone they need it. I think that'd be interesting. I don't know the answer to that. We also had Carlos Correa, his middle infield partner, as our shortstop.
Sticking with the Astros infield. The Astros, the accolades, they just don't stop, you know. MVPs, all Statcast team. It's really just the award season is really a cornucopia for them.
I mean, this is because he's got the strongest arm in baseball as a shortstop. And I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. I never really thought of him that way. Like, I think a strong arm's a shortstop. I think, Didi Gregorius, Brandon Crawford, probably. I always knew he had a good arm. I never really thought of him that way. But, you know, when he was promoted to the bigs in 2015, I looked back at our own scouting report at the time, and the report said he's a rocket arm with accuracy. His arm strength has a scouting grade of 70 on the 20 to 80 scouting scale. And it looks like that's paid off. And what's cool about this is that it's actually improved each year. His first year, he was fifth out of 35 who had at least 10 maximum effort throws, 86.1 miles an hour.
That's shortstops, right?
Of shortstops, yeah. Yes. And then in 2016, that went up from 86.1 to 87.5. And then in this year, it went from 87.5 to 88.1, which was the hardest average maximum effort on a first of 36 guys who had at least 10 throws. That's cool. Like, he actually keeps improving in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite plays of the postseason, possibly like my personal favorite play of the postseason, was that I think it was game two of the ALCS. It was kind of early in the game, and Brett Gardner hit one into the corner. And, you know, he gets around first, and he decides he's going to try and go for three. And, you know, Josh Reddick goes and, like, scoops it up and basically does this, like, weird, almost, like, underhand relay throw, but it is an absolutely perfect relay throw. And Correa grabs it and just throws an absolute seed to third base. I guess it was to Bregman. To get Gardner by a hair, and it was like the most perfectly executed relay throw you can imagine. There was this great camera angle that was like from like the right field, almost like the right field upper deck, where you could see it like a full view from behind Reddick. It was an amazing play.
It's a shame he hurt himself, because he might have been in the AL MVP conversation as well.
I mean,
he might have won it.
I thought when he went down, like the day up until that point, I thought he was AL MVP.
Yeah, and he very well might have been. Third base, Manny Machado. We got a lot of mileage out of this one, I think, this year. Manny Machado did not have a very strong first half. A 296 on base, he hit 230. But at the time, we could see he was hitting the ball really, really hard. At the All-Star break, he had the most batted balls, hit 95 miles an hour or more. And as the season ended, he also had the most. He had the most batted balls, 250 balls that we qualified as a hard-hit ball. That is 20 more than Jose Abreu, who was second. Machado hit 478 when he hit the ball 95 miles an hour or more and just 170 under. It's obviously very good to hit the ball hard, and that's why when he was struggling in the first half, we were able to look at it and say, well, he's still got the skill of hitting the ball hard. This is going to turn around at some point, and it did. He was so much better in the second half, added 30 points of on base and 55 points of slugging. So this one's for you, Manny Machado, the king of hitting the ball hard the most times. Left field, this is one of my favorite ones. Tommy Pham. I think, I don't know, when did we start talking about Tommy Pham? Like April? Maybe May?
Credit to Mike. Mike was
driving
the Tommy Pham bandwagon. I picked him up. We talked about him on this show, and I went like picked him up in fantasy like that day. And although my fantasy team was not very good, Tommy Pham was a huge bright spot.
He got some down ballot MVP votes, I think, in like eighth or ninth place votes.
Yeah, I saw someone tweet this today. Basically, they said like the only reason Tommy Pham wasn't NL MVP is because the Cardinals thought Matt Adams was better than him
at left field.
Because like he got, and I think basically on a per game basis, if you go by like WAR or whatever, like I think that Tommy Pham led the majors or led the NL because he only played 128 games because he was in the minors to begin the year and he didn't get really locked down the job until I think like late May.
He's also one of our favorite social media personalities because he is hilarious. The top line stats speak for themselves. He hit 306, 411 on base, 520 slugging, and 23 home runs. Obviously a great season. But if you look a little deeper at the StatCast stats, there's a lot to like about Tommy Pham. If you look at his throwing arm among left fielders, we had 29 left fielders who had 10 max effort throws. His average of 93.7 miles an hour was second only to Starling Marte, 94.1. So that's really good. We had him as a plus six outs above average. He's an above average outfielder. When you look at sprint speed, his was 28.7, which is pretty close to being elite. That was actually the third highest among left fielders. And when you look at all the left fielders who put 100 non-grounders in play, so I'm talking about hitting the ball hard in the air here, there were 47 of them, and only one, Michael Conforto, who split his time in the corners, had a higher production than Pham's 720 weighted on base. And that's actually what I liked about him in the first place, because even last year he didn't play that much. But when you looked at his production hitting the ball hard in the air, he was fantastic. All he needed was health and opportunity, and he got that.
And with that, you know, and we're seeing now also the Cardinals, I think, are planning to put him in center field and move Fowler to left, make more use of that of Pham's speed. So they're obviously they've finally fully bought into the Tommy Pham experience. And I want to make one more point about Pham because I know on Joe Posnanski's podcast, he and Mike Schur have really tried to like take over with the whole Tommy Pham fan club. We were there first. So slow your roll. You know, we appreciate that. You know, Pham is for the people. Everyone can love Tommy Pham, but really, Mike was there first. I want to, you know, it's really for my co-host. I want to give him the credit for being the first one to really, he's really driving the bandwagon. And then Mike and Joe hopped on along with a lot of other people.
I appreciate that. The next two guys here, I don't imagine you have to guess too hard who our center fielder and right fielder are. Center fielder, Byron Buxton. We've talked about him once or 20 times on the show. This is pretty obvious. We're not going to rehash it all, but he's the fastest man in the majors, 30.2 feet per second sprint speed. When we broke out outs above average, he was number one, plus 24 outs. He broke his own home-to-home record with a 13.85 inside the Parker. Tough for me to see anybody breaking that anytime soon, unless it's him. I think he put to rest the fact that even if he's barely a hitter, everything else he brings makes him a solid major leaguer, and I still think he's going to hit.
Yeah, there's this feeling that like there's like a slight adjustment in there that could unlock, you know, a guy who's actually like rivals Mike Trout.
We've seen it at times too. Yeah. Like he's been there for a minute, but if he just gets there consistently, but there's no more fun defender for me to watch in baseball than Byron Buxton.
Here.
Right field. Do you wonder who right field is going to be? It's Aaron Judge. You may have heard a few things about how hard Aaron Judge hit the ball this year. First in hard hit percentage, he set a new barrels record, 87 barrels this year. He hit the longest home run of the year, 495 feet. He hit the hardest home run of the year, not the same home run, 121.1 miles an hour. He had four of the five hardest hit balls of the year. He hit four separate 500-foot home runs at the Home Run Derby, including that 513-foot one that basically left the state. He also had the highest expected weighted on base in the 3 years of StatCast at 446, and one of only 13 outfielders with a throw tracked at 99 miles an hour. He can do it all. This is partially like this list is why I was like, this man is a deserving MVP. Obvious rookie of the year.
For sure.
Starting pitcher, we went with Max Scherzer with a caveat, which we'll get to in a second. Max Scherzer led all starting pitchers with an elite 242 expected weighted on base. That accounts for strikeouts and walks, but also quality of contact. His 34.4% strikeout rate, second only to Chris Sale. 29.2% hard hit rate was ninth best in baseball. He is, in a lot of ways, the perfect starting pitcher. He throws hard, You can't make contact, and when you do, you don't get good things out of it. And a part of that was because he's got this extremely high spin four-seam fastball, 2,504 RPM. That is third behind Verlander and Darvish of 193 guys who threw 200. Max Scherzer, Cy Young Award winner, and possibly on a path to Cooperstown. I don't think it's controversial to say that anymore.
Yeah, no, it's not. Although Joe Sheehan wrote a really interesting piece about him this week, sort of taking that into account and also acknowledging the fact that, like, you know, part of, and I love Max Scherzer. Max Scherzer is my favorite pitcher in baseball to watch pitch. I'll preface this by saying that. But Joe made a good point, or I should say an interesting point, sort of comparing him to similar players at similar ages and just sort of acknowledging that, well, two things. One of which is that, like, part of his last two signings are because of Clayton Kershaw's back.
Sure.
But I guess, you know, health is a skill, so to credit to Scherzer. But, you know, we've seen a lot of pitchers, and he compared him to Johan Santana, who, like, were amazing until 31 and then, you know, didn't do much after that. Even Roy Halladay, you know, I obviously don't want to bring him up in light of his unfortunate passing, but similar guy who at, you know, 32, 33 was, like, on top of the world, and then by, like, 34 was basically out of the game. So pitchers, it's just, like, it's hard to know when they're on a Cooperstown path. On the flip side, a lot of the guys who end up in Cooperstown as pitchers didn't look like Hall of Famers when they turned 30. Like, you know, Randy Johnson at 30 didn't look like a Hall of Famer, and then he basically was, like, you know, the best pitcher in baseball for the next 9 years.
Well, I'd see. If I am still fortunate enough to be working in baseball in 8 years, I will have a vote for the Hall of Fame. And I can't imagine Max Scherzer will be in by then. He's still got a couple more years ahead of him, and then you have to wait 5 more years. So I'm really hopeful I will get a chance to cast a vote for Max Scherzer in the Hall of Fame. I think that'll be hopefully cool.
Yeah, the other point is that there's all these guys that are sort of still, like, waiting. You know, Mike Messina, Curt Schilling, and you certainly say that Max Scherzer hasn't reached what they've done in terms of career value.
They should have been in several years
ago. Yes, but, like, but the point is that the point is, when we talk about who is going to be, not who you think should be, if they're going to make it or not, you know, if the voters have rejected Messina and Schilling, and Kevin Brown basically fell off the ballot instantly.
Dave Steeb, someone else should be,
you know,
there.
It doesn't really bode well for someone like Scherzer, unless, like, the standard for starting pitchers changes dramatically. And maybe it might at some point, but until it does, he has a lot of work to do.
I guess maybe I shouldn't say this without thinking more about it. The only slam dunk starting pitcher right now is going to Cooperstown is Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah, I think Verlander probably now is the narrative. But
Hernandez, like, kind of depends. Like, he had a great 20s, and the 30s don't look so good. Sabathia will probably have a case.
I think if Verlander has, like, two more, like above average seasons, you know, like, he's
sure
locked in. He might be in now, but I think that, like, with two more, like, you know, 3 or 4 win seasons, but in terms of war, not, you know,
right,
wins, he's in.
Yeah, Greinke will be in the conversation. But I think for right now, Kershaw is probably the only one who's slam dunk right now.
Agreed.
Relief pitcher Kenley Jansen, and, you know, there are a lot of great relievers in baseball these days. He led all pitchers with a 198 expected weighted on base. And I really want to put that in context for you because I think this number is cool. We looked at 254 relievers who faced 100 batters. And when you look at number 2 through number 20 in lowest expected weighted on base, they're kind of tightly bunched around, you know, from a 216 to 246. So number 2 overall had a 216, and Jansen wasn't number 1 by a little bit, 198. I mean, that is a huge gap. That is absolute dominance, 42.3% strikeout rate, second only to Kimbrel. I mean, this is a guy who's had, what, 5 or 6 amazing years now, and then he took it to an entirely new level this year.
Yeah, he's something.
And then I said there's a caveat when it came to starting pitchers, so I guess there's an honorable mention. And if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know that whenever we talk about Buxton or Judge, there's always a third man who comes up, and it's not Seth Lugo, not this year. It is, drumroll please, Luis Perdomo. Matt, please do the honors. Why is he our honorable mention this year?
He is by far the fastest pitcher on the base.
The fastest pitcher.
By far. He is to pitchers with J.D. Realmuto is to catchers. His sprint speed, 29.2 feet per second, is elite. It's faster than, like, Trey Turner. Just to give you a sense of the type of speed that Luis Perdomo has. He hit 4 triples this year. The last pitcher who had 4 triples in a season was Robin Roberts in 1955. The Blue Jays, as a team, hit 5 triples this year. Luis Perdomo had 4, and he comes by honestly with that elite speed.
All right. Well, I'm glad we were able to find a way to get Luis Perdomo on this team. So that is the 2017 All-StatCast team, and that'll be an article up on the site soon. So thanks for listening. We'll take next week off for the holiday. We'll be back in December to gear up for the winter meetings, I guess, and hopefully a lot of trades coming soon. So that is the MLB.com StatCast podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Catch you later.